This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
The enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and with me today is they called him King Rex at one point in time, a Kentucky basketball player of some renown, and now, I guess a social influencer, but also probably better known to people in Kentucky because he still is on TV in Kentucky talking about basketball. With me is Rex Chapman. Rex, it's a pleasure to have you here, man. Thanks for coming.
Brian, thanks for having me. I hope I'm not out of my depth.
No,
this is a smart podcast.
Well, thanks. We'll try to keep everybody in their depth. Hey now. So Rex will be with us to talk about politics and, of course, Kentucky basketball and a few other things. Stick around. We'll be right back. Hi, and welcome back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. With me today, as I said, is former Kentucky basketball great Rex Chapman, and of course, well-known on Twitter and social media. And if you've watched him, he's also a basketball, I guess, I wouldn't say announcer, color guy? Is that the
analyst?
Right one? Analyst? There you go. Yeah, there you go.
Sounds cool.
So thanks for joining us, right? And I'm going to start out because as a Kentucky boy myself, I can't start without talking about Kentucky basketball. And so you were, you know, I remember when you were destroying teams when you were playing basketball for Kentucky, but you didn't get the NCAA title. That still stick
right.
with you?
Oh yeah. Well, you know, I grew up in Western Kentucky, and I had initially committed to Louisville. Louisville was sort of my dream school.
Wow.
And
I bet Denny, I didn't know.
Yeah. Denny Crum had recruited me. He was really the first school that I felt was like a huge program. And they started recruiting me before Kentucky did. And I just kind of always grew up. Daryl Griffith is my all-time favorite player. I tried to play like Daryl. I tried to be Daryl. And so I loved U of L. And then right before my senior season, Joby Hall resigned. Eddie Sutton came to Kentucky.
Right.
And I went for a visit. Loved it. My grandmother lived in Lexington. And went to UK. Loved it. I had two really fun years. I still feel like we should have won it my sophomore year.
I thought you all were going to win it.
Yeah, and got upset by Villanova. And then, you know, and then I entered the draft. You know, we were going to go on probation, it looked like.
Yeah.
And and so we didn't.
Kentucky
I didn't
had
know
a few problems with recruiting violations.
We had some issues.
Did you ever live in the basketball dorm, the infamous basketball dorm?
Wildcat Lodge?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's where we lived. When I first got there, it had a 24-hour cook that you could come in any time of the night, order bacon and eggs, order any steak and eggs, anything you wanted, it 24 hours a day. We had like 8-foot-long beds, big TVs in the room, and individual bathrooms in your dorm room, which was unheard of in the 80s. And yeah. So the second year, though, the NCAA came in and said, no, you got to take all this stuff out of here, lock the door. You got to lock the bathroom doors. You can't use it. It's got to look like every other dorm. So we still had some.
You got it for 1 year?
Had it for 1 year, yeah.
Yeah, that one was part of the, I remember reading all the infractions, and that was one of the
perks
that they made you get rid of.
Yeah, well, hey, there's worse things.
How do you weigh in on the Kentucky and Louisville rivalry?
I love it. And I love, you know, Rick Pitino is one of my really good friends for 30 years now. John Calipari's been very kind to me over the years, even though I don't really have, you know, a long relationship with him. I hated to see Rick leave because I thought the rivalry was just epic with Cal and Rick and, you know, their relationship. They're not real friendly. But I think over time they've grown to kind of respect one another more. I hated to see Rick go, but I love Chris Mack. Chris Mack is a great basketball coach. Right. And he brings toughness to this rivalry, and he's not afraid to stir it up. I really enjoy, you know, we just have great basketball in the state. Western, Murray, what a program now.
Well, Kentucky and Louisville didn't have much of a
program this year. Not this year. Oh, it was tough.
What happened? But it was tough, though. I couldn't watch it. I couldn't.
Yeah. Couldn't. You know, I really reveled in Duke having a bad year, but I couldn't revel too much.
We all revel in Duke having a bad year.
Yeah.
I saw a meme one time that said, some of you may love, love Trump. Some of you may love Biden, but everybody hates Christian Leitner.
Very true. Very true. No, I couldn't revel too much because we were having an equally shitty year here at Kentucky. I really do think when you look at the similarities both programs had this year, when you look at it from the 50,000 foot view, I mean, they have 5-6 guys. Their turnover is 100% every year, or almost 100%. They're getting brand new freshmen in. When due to the pandemic, my opinion is when you can't get those kids in right after they graduate in the spring and get them enrolled in classes, get them on the weights, get them conditioning, doing all that stuff, getting them used to, you know, what it's going to be like
to play high caliber basketball, right?
Right. And then you don't have them all summer. Then you only get these young men to come in and women to come in the fall. I mean, you're really behind. They're no more than glorified high school, you know, all-star players at this point. They don't have a bit of a clue how to, you know, play defense, sit in the stance, all of that stuff. And I think both programs really, and then given the fact that, you know, you're practicing for 10 days and then off for 10 days due to COVID or whatever it was, I just think they were playing catch up all year long. We started, I could see us around, you know, the time of the SEC tournament, I felt like Kentucky was where we normally are around January, you know, mid season and trending to get better. Cause it's, you know, when you have so many young players, it's just hard to, you know, teach them in a condensed period of time.
Isn't that the deeper problem? One and done. I mean, Sutton complained about it. I know others have at Kentucky and Louisville. And, and that was one of the preaches that Denny Crum had for years, was the one and done has destroyed college basketball. Can that be undone?
I don't know because I think the tube the toothpaste may be out of the tube at this point due to the fact that anymore, and especially in the last 4 or 5 years, you're seeing high schoolers, you know, McDonald's All-American type players not go to college. You know, a couple, 2 or 3 are going overseas, going to Australia and playing for that 1 year. And they're playing against pro players, maybe a little better than college competition, or they're going to the G League, which you can now go to the G League straight out of high school and, you know, be paid, I'm going to make this up, $190,000, right? Which that's big to almost everyone in America. So, and they're seeing that these kids are getting drafted and drafted high, and it's not hurting their stock not playing in college. I'm partial to college. I'm sure you are as well. I love college basketball for what it we've always felt like it is. I think it's better
than watching NBA. I would much rather watch a good college basketball game than an NBA. But
the reason that I believe that is because the players aren't as good. And I do enjoy it because seven guys on the floor might just lose their mind at any point in time. The NBA players are really good. You know, when they lose their mind, it's a big deal. So, it's just more unpredictable. But they're younger, and they're not, you know, they are pros. I mean, they're being paid something now, and they should be paid. But
that's the other issue in college basketball.
That is the other issue, and I think
the Supreme Court even weighed in on that. You know, how can you not pay these people? You're taking something from them. And I mean, did you feel that way when you were in college? You wanted to see that?
I didn't initially. And I got to say, most young men don't, young men and women don't. I think they're starting to see, and I think they're starting to see that there's a difference. I didn't know, for instance, that the second I signed my letter of intent, I signed away my image and likeness in perpetuity.
Yes. Forever.
I came here about 7 or 8 years ago with my daughter, who was a freshman at Kentucky, and I went to the orientation with her. And on the video, you know, the welcome video for hundreds of parents and the kids, I was on the video 2 or 3 times playing basketball. And I, you know, here I am, I'm paying tuition over here.
So, hey Rex, thanks for your work. Give us some more money. Yeah. We love you. Yeah. And we love your money even more.
That's right.
So, your likeness, that's for us.
That's ours.
Yeah, that seems screwy to me.
And so, you know, we didn't really understand that. I think, you know, now we're going to see more of that. I think a lot of people don't want to think of, I've had this conversation with friends who've said, yeah, but I don't want guys driving Mercedes Benz around campus and this and that. And I said, okay, all right. I said, that's fine. Just as long as you know that Buffy and, you know, Biff over at the sorority houses, they're driving their parents' Mercedes all around campus and on their money. And these are these guys' money. They can do with it what they want. So I think we're caught up in, you know, this whole sort of that pristine thing that we think is amateurism when it's never really been pristine.
I remember in college, there were a couple of kids and I went to the University of Missouri, and there were a couple of really good players, John Sutton being among them, and a real tall guy who shall remain nameless, who's our center.
I know who it is.
Yeah. Stipo. And they never had to take a test. I was in a couple of classes with them. They weren't amateurs.
And I remember when Steve shot it. Remember when he shot himself in the leg?
Yes. So I wasn't going to mention him. I kind of felt bad for him. And how do you fail a class you don't attend? I don't know. Anyway, no. I'm not going to say disparage anybody. I mean, because a lot of players come from, and particularly if you come from a less than middle class environment, and your one grace, one thing that's going to get you out of that is your ability to play ball. Yeah. Why shouldn't you get paid for what you do?
The hardest thing I saw, and I still, it kind of makes me emotional when I think about it now, and I won't say his name, but he was a great player. He was a year behind me, freshman from Georgia, and really super talented. And from the time he got to campus in August till we started practice on October 15th, he gained 25 pounds, 6'6" guy, but gained 25 pounds. It was a noticeable difference. And come to find out, this was just the first time he'd had a meal card and could eat 3 times a day. He'd eaten once a day his whole life. Now you tell me that young man's going to come to school. He's going to need money. I mean, you're going to need money, whether it's to do laundry or just go on a date or what, you're going to need money. And when you don't have that, and then you're not being paid. And then at that point in time, we couldn't even have jobs. You couldn't have a job.
And they're taking your likeness, so you can't make money from it. Right. Kinda, it's like slavery to me.
Now, well, I think it is.
It's an indentured servitude.
Yeah. And I didn't really realize that at the time. And also, there's the whole mind fuck thing of you know, you're chasing your dream, and this is one way to, actually, it's the only way to get there. We thought at the time was you got to go to college, you got to do this and that, and if you want to go on and play after that, that's the springboard to do it. So I think it's messy right now, and I think the NCAA is having to come to terms with you know, years of kind of not doing things the right way, and I'm hopeful that they're going to start doing so or be forced to do so.
Well, do you think college basketball, as you grew up loving it, as I grew up loving it, has ceased to exist?
I think it's going to be different. And when I say that, my dad was a college basketball coach. He coached Division II at Kentucky Westland. And I grew up watching Division II basketball, and I love Division II basketball in many ways.
I was a Bellarmine College fan. My dad was the announcer for Bellarmine.
I went to camp at Bellarmine a couple summers.
Did you?
And I used to go to those
Joe
games.
Joe Rybel and Gene Spaulding. Those were the guys I grew up. And every year they would play Louisville and get their butts.
Yeah. But I loved that Louisville would play them.
Yeah. You know, and then great. Denny Crum, when he came along, said, no, we're not playing them anymore.
But my dad was a college basketball coach. And so I saw more live D2 ball than I did D1.
Me too.
For many regards, you got to be a better player at D2. They don't have the athletes, you know, everybody's about 4 inches shorter, and then they're not, you know, not as athletic. But when you're not as athletic, you got to be more fundamentally sound, because you can only play around and through people. You can't play over the top of them. Right. And so what I think we're going to see more of, and it's not going to be a dramatic, but I think we're going to see more of Division II style basketball at the Division I level.
Wow.
And I don't think that that's bad, because these kids are going to stay 4 years. And yes. I really miss that as a fan. I grew up watching, you know, I planned on being in school 4 years. I didn't plan on leaving. I wanted to win a championship. That's what I grew up watching. Everybody that I grew up watching, Daryl Griffith stayed 4 years, you know, Sam Bowie.
Never nervous. Bowie. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I like that.
And before that, Rupp's Runts.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, you get to know, the community gets to know the young man and woman, and vice versa. You get to see them grow up.
Yeah. Two things to hit on before we go to the break. I guess one of them is I touched lightly on the rivalry between Louisville and Kentucky. And I was always, look, I grew up in Louisville. I had scholarship offers from both Louisville and Kentucky for academics, didn't take them and left. But growing up in Louisville, I always bled red. My dad was, and of course, you know, much like every other family in Kentucky, half the family was a Kentucky fan, half the family was a Louisville fan. And every Christmas time around that era, once they started playing each other, there was a friendly rivalry and much Kentucky bourbon imbibed as we watched the games and taunted each other. But but there was always, it seemed to me, and I think it was Patino who said, you know, Louisville fans, even if they are for Louisville, they don't live and breathe it. They can walk away from it, where Kentucky doesn't. And I saw some pretty unhealthy things too in that rivalry. Did that ever bother you? And did you find it to be the same way?
Yes. Yes. You know, a quick story, Purvis Ellison and I played on the USA team. Denny Crum was the coach. This was between my freshman and sophomore year. So we were in Louisville. We spent the whole summer in Louisville. But myself, Kenny Payne, and Purvis Ellison, they both played for Louisville. We went to the mall one day, Oxmoor. And
my mother used to be the promotional director there. Small world.
We walk walk into Oxmoor, and I just got flooded with people. I was probably 18 or 19 at the time. I got flooded with pictures and autographs, and I wasn't able to move. You know, I ended up staying there. We probably left after 20 minutes because people, you know, it was just sort of a mob, Kentucky fans.
Yeah.
Purvis and Kenny, they had just won the national championship a year before.
Yeah.
They just sat over on the other side of the mall and sat there by themselves talking and, you know, weren't bothered one bit. It's just it's unhealthy in some regards. And it's difficult to negotiate as a young person because you've got your coaches, you know, telling you every day, look, man, you're not that good. You still got to get better. You got to learn to do this and that. And every time you walk out of the gym or Wildcat Lodge, the fans are telling you how great you are. And you're young. You're just so young.
A Louisville fan, you know, you could walk away. I would cheer for Kentucky if Louisville wasn't playing them. You know,
I cheer for Louisville. Yeah. And it pisses people off when I say that. I cheer for Louisville when we're not playing them.
But Kentucky fans will never cheer for Louisville. and with the possible exception of when they play Duke.
That's right.
And even then, it's kind of iffy. And there was another meme I saw one time. It was a picture. It goes, here's people rioting in Buffalo. Nope, scratch that. It's Kentucky fans rioting because they won a basketball game. so true.
You, it is crazy. And there, yeah, you know, there's ups and downs with it. But there's nothing like playing in that building when that place is rocking. And, you know, because it can really give you a boost.
Yeah, that's, you know, and I grew up, like I said, my dad was an announcer for Bellarmine, and I grew up in Knights Hall, you know, Bellarmine
campus. Oh, yeah.
And there's still something special about that. And Freedom Hall was the same.
No question.
And then, of course, you know, but when I first started watching Kentucky basketball, first game I attended was not at Rupp Arena.
At Memorial?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where? Who do you remember? What year?
It was 60. It was Rupp's Runts, the year of Rupp's Runts.
Yeah. You know, we played a
and I think it was Alabama. And
Really?
And it was a hell of a game. I remember that.
So Rupp was coaching?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. The first I met him.
Yeah, I remember him at all as a coach. My earliest recollection is of Joe B. Hall. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Joe B. Hall always reminded me of, I guess, Gerald Ford. He was the Gerald Ford of Kentucky basketball.
Yeah.
But that brings me to the other question.
Okay.
You played at Kentucky, and I'm just going to be as blunt as I can. It's not the most, and I was, like I said, I visited the campus. It's not the most enlightened group of people in the world. In fact, racism is very prevalent, and Rupp was one of the last coaches to integrate his, I think it was Tom Payne, right? That was the first black player on his team. And that was in 71. And they made a big deal out of the fact Rupp's Runts were great, but they lost to an integrated team in the NCAA final. And Louis Dampier was on that team. That's what I remember that one. And I know from your bio, you had some problems with racism on that campus. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. You know, honestly, you said enlightened, and growing up in Kentucky, that's all I knew. You know, I didn't know other places were different. I didn't know if you went to other geographical regions that, you know, mindsets were different and, you know, philosophies and life. And I didn't know any of that. The schools I went to visit, they were all in the South. It was Kentucky, Louisville, Western, Carolina, and Georgia Tech. So when I got to Kentucky, I didn't know anything about Adolph Rupp's past. You know, I was a kid I didn't think anybody before me was better. You know,
didn't the name Adolph give it away?
I didn't. And then when I was here, you know, I had a black girlfriend in high school, and we're still terrific friends to this day, but she came to UK as well. And we kind of were encouraged to hide it in high school. And so when we got to college, we're like, well, that's dumb. You know, we should go to class together and, you know, sit together and do all that. And people didn't like it. Many people didn't like it. students, adults, and many people at the university didn't like it. And it's one of those things that when I think about it, it kind of exhausts me, just because I didn't realize at the time how wrong they were.
You were made to feel like you were doing something wrong.
Yeah, and that's how I internalized it. But think about how she had to internalize it. She had to internalize it as, this is fucking me. You know, what are you talking about? What? So, so it took, you know, just negotiating that for a couple of years. I loved everything about my experience at UK, except that was really kind of, it was taxing, and
it was fucked up is what it was. Yeah. I can't say it any other way. It's fucked up.
Live and learn.
Yeah. So, when we come back, we were going to talk a little bit more about what happened to you after basketball and where you are now. This is Just Ask the Question. I'm your host, Brian Karam. We'll be right back. Well, time to pay the bills, folks. And this one I don't mind doing. I've actually used this. If this 2020 holiday season feels like it's been a long time, come and make it worth the wait with Omaha Steaks. Omaha Steaks makes the perfect gift for family and friends or to treat yourself. All shipped directly to your door. They offer everything you need to bring families together for a delicious holiday feast. Okay, or maybe not, maybe just a delicious festival. Their deluxe grillers assortment package includes a variety of entrees, sides, and desserts. Right now, you can get this mouth-watering package. I've never actually seen a mouth water. Plus 4 free burgers and a free digital meat thermometer. And we all need a good meat thermometer. And exclusive price only available to our listeners. So go to omahasteaks.com and enter the code QUESTION into the search bar. Get a jump on gift shopping with Omaha Steaks. You know, Omaha Steaks isn't just a steak. It's actually a lot of them. It's a fantastic gift and a safe way to share the joy of the season with Omaha Steaks. Guaranteed quality and safety with every order. Order the Deluxe Grillers Assortment Package today, and you'll receive 4 free Omaha Steak Burgers and a free digital meat thermometer. That's just a great straight line I won't use. When you go to omahasteaks.com and type question in the search bar, that's omahasteaks.com and type question. And if you need to spell it, it's QUESTION in the search bar, and you'll shop for the best gourmet gifts of the season. I like a good raw steak, so enjoy it. It is a lot of fun. Hi, it's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. With us today is Rex Chapman. They did call you King Rex when you were at Kentucky. How did King that Rex, come about?
King Rex, I guess Rex Latin. King Rex, and then Sexy Rexy. And Sexy Rexy, I came home. My first sport was swimming.
I heard them call you that on WLRS radio. Look, I like the guy playing basketball, but you know, to me, I'm sorry. I love you, Rex, but you ain't sexy.
But look at him. No, I swam as a kid, and you know, we wore the Speedos. I was 6 or 7 years old, and I came home from school or from practice one day just bawling, because a bunch of the older girls on the team were calling me Sexy Rexy, and I thought they were being mean to me. And my mom was like, "No, honey, they like you in the Speedo. Yeah.
Hello. Oh, Rex. Well, you know, you grew up in Owensboro. What can we say?
That's right.
So, after you left and you played, you were one of the first, I think you were the first drafted by the Hornets, right? First player ever drafted by the Hornets. How long did you play in the NBA?
I played in the NBA 12 years. I was drafted by the Hornets in 1988. That was their first year in existence. And we were terrible, but
I remember.
when I first was drafted there, there was also an expansion draft that year. And in the expansion draft, the Hornets drafted Dell Curry, and Dell is Stephen and and Seth's dad, of course, and one of my best friends. When I pulled up into Charlotte, I was the youngest player in the NBA. I was 19. When I pulled into my apartment complex for the very first time, all by myself, two doors down was Dell and Sonya, and Stefan had just been born. Dell had a broken arm, and they came out and helped me move in my stuff. And from that day on, we've just been the best of buddies. And it's been amazing watching his kids grow up. But I played there for 4 years, or 3.5 years, was traded to Washington, played with the Bullets, the old Bullets.
And that's, let me, because you also, you played with, well, you played in management at that time was Wes Unsel.
Wes coached me. He was our coach while I was there. Yeah, one of my favorite people ever.
He used to, his brother, I told you this in the break, I played briefly in high school and averaged more fouls per game than points as a linebacker. That was my position. And George, his brother, was there. And I remember Wes would come in every once in a while before the high, you know, and play and just his, one of his legs was big around as I was. Man, it's unbelievable. He's massive.
Yeah.
You know, the other person we from high school, I remember, I don't know if you remember his name, Joe Red Hagen.
Yeah, I know the name. I remember my dad saying the name forever.
Yeah. He had the record in alumni gym. He was a University of Kentucky basketball player.
Really?
And in 1933 or something, had this, he had the longest shot ever shot in alumni gym. They put a nail in the floor where he did. And I had the Rupp years, the book that the Courier Journal had published, Rupp years. And so, you know, my brother and I, big, you know, basketball fans, would read that back when. And one day I opened it up and I go, this looks like my PE teacher. Like before he was an old fart. So, so I remember I took it to him. I said, is this you? And he said, yeah, nobody remembers that anymore. I go, well, I do. Hey, that was so cool.
That's
and
awesome.
He just thought it was cool that somebody remembered him. So,
absolutely.
So there's a lesson that Kentucky and Louisville can get along together. Wes, George Unsel and Joe Hagen. But what was it like having Wes as your coach?
Wes was great. And he, you know, he taught me, I learned maybe more about life from Wes than anything we did in basketball. He was a dad already. He had kids in high school. I was a new dad. You know, I talked to him about, I remember one night we were on the plane and we were flying back from somewhere, and myself, Kenny Walker, and Wes were sitting up in the front, and Kenny, my guy, Kenny from Kentucky. Yeah. So
Kenny Skywalker.
And so he had two Kentuckians on the, or two Kentucky basketball players on the team. And then Purvis was on the team. LeBradford Smith was on the team.
Wow.
So a couple Louisville guys.
Hell of a good team.
Yeah. And then we were all real young though. We were terrible. And so, but Kenny and I were sitting up with Wes, and he went into talking about the Adolph Rupp recruiting he and Butch Beard. And, you know, he got down to the end of it. He said, he came in and he looked at us and said, you know, I'm just not sold on you guys coming to the University of Kentucky. And he said, you know, I know the media has made a big deal about it. And, you know, they're here. They met at Wes's house in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
Butch's family did too. And they didn't really even know each other. That's where they UK wanted to meet. So, you know, I didn't know any of that stuff. I didn't know I didn't know that when I got to college, I didn't know that they'd only had a black player for the first time, you know, 15 years ago.
Right.
You know, I just grew up, I was born in 67 and a lot of that stuff that happened before, I never paid attention to.
Yeah, that's, well, in Louisville, we didn't really, I mean, there was the busing riots in the 70s. So we kind of, but my grandparents marched with Martin Luther King, and being Lebanese in the last
year
of Kerem, I didn't really have the luxury of being that, you know, it wasn't benign to me. It was,
right.
It was something that we saw, and, you know, it was Muhammad Ali. It was Wes Unsel. Those were the two guys when I was growing up that meant more to me in the civil rights movement than anything, were those two
same,
guys.
And same Wes, for me. Same for me. I remember growing up in the, you know, in the 70s and watching every fight, Ali fight, and taking great pride. My parents saying, look, he's from Louisville. Yeah, and, well, you know, and then, you know, him.
He was a friend of the family. My Uncle Louie gave him his very, my Uncle Louie, there's a picture of him in the documentary that's out on Ali. My Uncle Louie is handing him his very first trophy he ever won. It was a Golden Gloves trophy.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, it was.
He was one of the biggest thrills of my life. I was 17 or 18. So I was a freshman at Kentucky, and we played Louisville in Freedom Hall, and we blew them out. We blew them out. and I had a really good game. And
I remember that game. I lost money on it. Bastard.
Well, you're welcome. And but after the game, I went to do the press. And then I was coming back from the press, and our PR guy, Brad Davis, grabbed me and said, hey, Champ wants to talk to you. And I went, what? And I turned the corner, and Muhammad Ali was standing there. And, you know, he was just, you know, he just started wearing the sunglasses, and he wasn't, you know, articulating himself as well. I don't even remember what we talked about. It was very brief, but I was just in complete shock. You know, that here's this guy that I've, you know, and he, admired. I'm not sure I even knew he was at the game. And when I thought about that afterwards, I was like, God, I'm glad I didn't know he was here.
Well, I have to tell, I'll tell you my Muhammad Ali story. I think it was nine and my dad got me involved in boxing. So I was boxing with the Louisville Police Athletic League. Same place where Muhammad Ali learned to box. Obviously, I was not as good. But all of us that were boxing got to meet the champ. And we got to get in the ring with him for, you know, like 2 minutes in shadow box. And that was, to me, I was, there's an old Richard Pryor bit where he says, you know, I got in the ring with Muhammad Ali for a benefit. And he said, did this motherfucker know what's about? He was afraid that at any minute he was going to have a flashback and go, Joe Frazier, round 11, ping. And one of his punches would give me brain damage. And I'm 9 years old going, is Muhammad Ali going to kick my ass? Because he sat there and he was going, white boy looks so mean and so clean, but I look at me, I'm the champ. I've never been, you know, I was like, uh-oh, I'm dead. I'm so pretty. I'm so clean. I don't care if the white boy's mean, you know, and we all got our picture with him afterwards. But I remember I will take that memory with me to my grave.
Absolutely. I'm bigger than life, you know.
Everything he did is bigger than life. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, hell, he was with there's a picture of him with the Beatles. And I was a big Beatle fan, and I'm going, I get to stand next to a guy who's
touched the Beatles.
Up the Beatles. What the hell? And it impressed me that he was, you know, from my hometown. It made a huge impression on me that, because I don't know about you, but growing up in Kentucky, a lot of times you felt like you could never get out of Kentucky.
See, that I'm with you. I'm glad you brought that up. And I'm glad that we now have other avenues, you know, really and truly I guess I could have gone to college. Maybe I would have. I didn't like school. But my own, you know, the only real way to get out of here is with sports. Yeah. And if you're not in sports, but now, you know, with the gaming and there's a whole other, you know, kids can do other things and
my son is doing quite well
out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah. To get out and see the world. And if you want to come back, come back, but to be able to get out and do things. It used to be, and I'm with you for Muhammad Ali. It was, and then learning, you know, well, he changed his name, Mom, and learning what that was all about and his, you know, going through changes in life.
God, I
knowing he was from Kentucky gave me all kinds of, you know, confidence that, hey, you can do things.
I could get out. That's made me, because I remember my grandfather, you know, we were at a party at my grandfather's house, and somebody was talking about him having changed his name and what right did he have to do that. And I'll never forget what my grandfather said. He said, a man can be called whatever he wants. It's his choice. You respect the man by respecting what he chooses to call himself. not what you think he should be called. And I was like, oh, okay. So, I mean, he
brilliant.
Yeah. Muhammad Ali taught me so much.
Same.
And he doesn't even know it. I mean, I mean, that's, and I'll tell you, I've traveled all around the world, and there are places where, you know, nobody knows who, you know, for example, Donald Trump is, but everybody knows who Muhammad Ali is.
Exactly.
Everybody. And that's, yeah. And that's, that impressed me. He walked around the same ground I did in Louisville. Yep. And to me, that was just, I honestly don't think there was anybody who made a bigger impression on me than that.
I could probably say the same.
So when you did have some problems, I mean, before you, and I want to get to the social stuff, but I mean, do you feel comfortable about talking about what happened to you?
Yeah, of course. You know, when I didn't have my first drink of alcohol till I was like 22. I didn't drink in college.
Well, there's the problem right there.
Yeah. See.
Yeah.
And so, and then
my great uncle handed me one when I was 12. You know, here's a highball, son. My mother went crazy.
And look, honestly, addiction on both sides of my family. You know, all the family get-togethers, my relatives, just a lot of drinking, and I just didn't. I was real and. Really, it boiled down to I was that, like, it's not going to help me. It's not going to help me. I was real super focused, hyper focused. And
that can be a problem for addiction. That's one of the reasons
Yes. And it also lets me know I was a basketball addict, you know, or a whatever it was, a golf addict, or I just horse racing. You know, I just would switch from one addiction to another. But when I finished playing, I'd had 7 surgeries my last 3 years.
What'd you have surgeries on?
Oh man, my wrist, my ankle, Achilles, shin, couple fingers, thumbs, just random stuff.
I used to say you could put my ankles on casters. They would fold up so easily.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what ended up happening at the end of my career. I'd turn my ankle anymore. It wouldn't hurt. It would just swell up. It'd swell up and I couldn't play for a couple of days. It gets no fun.
No.
So I'd had some injuries, but I had an emergency appendectomy right at the end of I was going to retire anyway. And doctor gave me OxyContin. He gave me a prescription for OxyContin and I took it. And Brian, in 2 days, I knew I was in love. Like I felt funnier, smarter, better dad, better husband. And really what it was just, it was so good. And it was every fleeting thought, every bad thought was sort of fleeting. Every good thought sort of hung around. And before I knew it, I was 18 months later and Danny Ainge is coming to me to say, hey man, you got a problem. You need to go to rehab. At the time, I was taking like 40 Vicodin a day and 10 OxyContin
Holy
a day,
shit.
And just chewing them.
You could OD on that much.
Yeah, well, see, thank goodness I wasn't a drinker because I would have for sure died. I mean, but this was 18 months building up to that, and so when I went to rehab, and then I was in and out of rehab 3 times. The last time it took in 2014. I went and took it seriously, started trying to learn about myself and, you know, why I, you know, kind of ran from whatever it was I was running from for so long.
What were you running from? What did you learn?
You know, I really think that some of the stuff that I think being known from such a young age and then going through some of that stuff that I did in college, I think that there was some stuff there that I really hadn't dealt with. You know, some animosity toward, you know, people that I felt like should have looked out for me a little better. But also, you know, at this point I'm 45 at that time. And, you know, you gotta do it yourself. And doesn't matter how you got there, whether it was, you were, you know, just trying to have fun or it, you know, you came by it honestly, you're there and now you got to get out of it. So I went.
When you say animosity, was it like people that you felt were teachers or parents or
all of that? Just coaches, you know, people that I thought, you know, at the time, you know, with some of the racism stuff that could have, you know, maybe helped me better, helped me understand. And, you know, I think that you know, I made decisions based on what other people thought and what they wanted instead of, you know, what I wanted. And I think I had some real resentment about it. So I've had to, shoot, I go to therapy and I try to talk about things because I am an addict and I can think myself into a bad mood like nobody's business.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah. But I got off the medicine about 7 years ago, almost 7 years ago. And, just tried to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And I'd probably made $40 million playing, but I was broke. I was living on a friend's couch.
Wow.
And really had to start putting one foot in front of the other to come back and learn how to live all over again.
When you say therapy, did you find that talking, I mean, one of the things that, and my family and I talk about this all the time now, we just don't talk. It's yeah. Like you just push ahead. And sometimes there are passive aggressive people in your family. There are people yeah. that are just aggressive, but instead of talking and getting it out, it builds up
yeah.
over time. Is that
what yes, happened? Yes, definitely. Yeah. And yeah, like you said, especially with family, me and my dad's still alive. He's 70, 75 now. And we just have a really hard time talking about anything that's not manly, that's not basketball right. or golf or the track or whatever.
Well, he's a Kentucky boy too. So,
right. So, but what's been beautiful about it is, he's never been better. And the older he gets, the better our relationship gets. And we always had a good relationship, but it's been good, getting to know my folks at when they're older, when so many of my friends' folks are not around anymore,
yes.
And I know they would just give anything. So I'm fortunate yeah. in that regard.
Yeah. That's my pop died. He was a huge fan of yours, by the way. Oh. I mean, he died when he was 55 of lung cancer.
Oh man. I'm sorry, Brian.
And that's 26
years. How old were you?
35 at the
Jeez.
Time. And so, I mean, every day I have on earth now is like, I think, wow, my pop didn't get to be this age.
Yeah.
And I still get to spend time with my kids.
Yeah.
And I know that's when he was dying. I remember, boy, you talk about a something that brought my life into focus. He was sitting there on the couch and he says, I'm not sitting here dying thinking I should have spent more time at the office. I wish I'd spent it with you all.
Yeah.
And I said, Pop, you're here now. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
But I did not want to have that regret with my kids.
Of course. I saw a great picture of you the other day with your boys.
Yeah, that
fantastic.
Was
fantastic. Good yeah, looking that, kids, man.
I'm very lucky in that regard. And we're all vaccinated now. And we all yep. did the lockdown. Same. And so we were able to
I've
make
got
it
four
happen.
Kids. I've four. Got four kids. They're all in their 20s now, but they've all been vaccinated.
How many boys, how many girls?
One boy, the oldest, and he's
oh, that's good. He's the oldest. So he's breaking oldest. Heads on the dates, right?
Yeah, 28. he's 28. So you're in Washington. Me and you will meet up in Brooklyn to see a game. He's in the Nets video room.
Now. I'm in.
And so we'll go see these guys in the playoffs.
Right. I'm definitely in.
That's, okay, I'm in.
Yeah, well, it's good that the boy is the oldest. Like I said, I yeah. was the oldest of four, and I had two younger sisters. And Dad used me as, the strike breaker, the enforcer
That's
on
right.
dates.
That That's was, right, yeah.
But it came
That's
in
what
handy.
He's done.
Being a football player helped.
That's right.
But you these days you're spending time not only as an analyst, but I mean, I see you all over Twitter. I mean, you get retweeted all the time. Well, how'd that happen?
It just really by accident. I wanted off of social media a couple of years ago. Trump had gotten me so down just with the racism. And living
welcome to my life
living in a place that's predominantly red, it was really getting me down, and I wanted off. And one day I was just watching a video. It was a school of dolphins sort of swimming into shore, and a guy paddle boarding out, mm-hmm. and one of the dolphins jumped up, hit him in the chest, and I said audibly, well, that's a fucking charge. And so, and I put that out.
basketball players everywhere are well aware of what you meant.
Right. And so, and also when I put that out, I just assumed some basketball people would get it, but other people, sports people, kind of thought it was funny or whatever. And that just kind of took off. And I started putting out those stupid videos, blocker charge videos. And before I knew it, it's a couple years later and the account had grown, you know, to over 1 million followers. And now people just send me videos. I'll get videos from movie studios saying, "Hey, would you put this out? Mind putting this out?" Like, sure, this is great.
Yeah. I get requests like that too. It always floors me. I go, what do you want me to put this out for?
Right. One of the coolest ones though, I got one from one morning I woke up, I had one from Sacha Baron Cohen. And he was really, you know, he was really on a movement to get Trump off of Twitter after the insurrection. And he said, "Rex, would you help me amplify this?" I said, "Absolutely, Sacha Baron Cohen." and within 2 days, he was off Twitter.
Well, and that was great. To me, that was, and here's, you know, you talk about being from a red state and, you know, Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell, and Mitch was one of the first politicians I ever, in fact, was the first outside of the family. And my uncle who had worked with him, because I, you know, Karam's in Louisville, or politics, huge. And my uncle said, "Listen, before you go into interview Mitch McConnell, you have to understand Mitch is about one thing." And I said, "What's that?" "Mitch McConnell." And he hasn't changed in 40 years.
No.
And being from Kentucky, I feel as you do, it hurts sometimes.
It hurts.
Because I know very good people from Kentucky and I really love the place, but it gets tainted by the hate and the bitterness and the anger.
And it sure does.
I remember.
I don't even know how you know, if you're Rand Paul, he voted against anti-Asian hate yesterday. I mean, what are we talking? He voted against an anti-lynching bill last summer. I mean, I don't talk about embarrassing. Yeah. It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing. And I know people that, I know people that would vote for both of them, but they aren't them. They would not.
Right. That's the hard part.
That's the hard part to make people understand. And I remember the day of the insurrection, and I'm telling you, brother, there were some really stupid people that day. I got my life threatened 3 or 4 times on that day. But I was standing there watching them crawl up the wall. And I said, what are you crawling up the wall for? There's steps on either side. Right. You can just, and they go, you're not Spider-Man. You're gonna end up. And one of them fell and broke his neck.
Of course.
And they were screaming at me as if I broke his neck. I'm going,
I told you
to walk up the steps, you moron. And I had one of them threaten me when they found out I was with Playboy, said, "Oh, can you invite me to a party?" And they stopped, but I met a guy from Kentucky, and that to me, and I can share this with you because I don't think anybody else would understand. It hurt me.
Yes.
Almost physically to see someone from Bardstown, Kentucky at that insurrection supporting the overthrow of our own government.
I had a couple of friends from Owensboro send me pictures of one's a pastor in Owensboro who was at the thing taking pictures with the guy with the horns on his head.
Chewbacca.
Yeah. And you just go, man, that's right. That's my hometown.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you, I don't know. I don't know, man. Yeah. Do you have hope for, you almost left social. I almost did too, but when people started picking up when I was posting stuff, actually when I got in a fight with Trump, that was when people started. Yeah.
Again, and I picked plenty of, I was not bashful on my displeasure for Trump. And that's not a popular stance to have around these parts. So,
no, I've been home a few times. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. Just a weird, weird time. I'm hopeful just because, over the last month or two, just with a new administration, it seems like we're kind of, and with being vaccinated, being on a plane again, it seems like the world is starting to come back a little bit. You know, you're in the airport, there's a little more buzz in the airport. You go to an arena, there's a few more people in the arena. And I do think we all, there's more good than bad of us. And we had a real cancer in the White House that sowed division every day. John Cornyn talking about Biden's tweets aren't creative enough. What? What are we talking about anymore? What?
They're not divisive enough. He hasn't threatened enough people. What's wrong with Joe Biden? Why didn't he get out and tweet more acrimony? God. Yeah. I
mean, what are we doing?
I don't know how these people get. I do know how they get elected, and of course, I think voter suppression is one of the big and gerrymandering of districts and all of that. And that I mean, you can't gerrymander the whole state. So Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell are you know not part of that.
Yeah.
But the state legislature, the your members of Congress of the House, all those districts are all very much gerrymandered, and it's very difficult, and that's how you end up with I mean, I can't believe that you are, and I've interviewed them, let's talk, you know, Boebert or
and Green
who sit there, I don't need to wear a mask, God takes care of me, then why are you wearing a gun?
Yeah, what do you got a gun for?
Yeah, if God's gonna take care of you, what?
Come on. It's and selective. They got no answer.
No. Answer. Well, there's some very dumb people, and that's dangerous.
You know, you can have different beliefs. They're dangerous.
Yeah, that's the point. It is dangerous. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back for a few final words. Thanks for sticking around. This has been a lot of fun. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast. Again, that's at JATQ Podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. With me is Rex Chapman, who, I lost money betting against him when he was playing for Kentucky. but I'm glad he's here today. Rex, I get, you know, we talk about the racism. I mean, you and I both grew up in Kentucky, which was, you know, there was, and there still is. And I think about the shootings that have gone on, and it's, there are two, there are three pandemics. There's the legitimate, you know, COVID pandemic. There's also a pandemic of mass shootings. There was one in Louisville when I was, you know, at Standard Gravure a few years back. And then there's the pandemic of shooting black kids that seems to go on. And, you know, as two paler people, and you and I grew up, I mean, I felt, I kind of straddled the line. We were white because, you know, of our, every time somebody mentioned Karam, you know, was a Muslim but I don't know what it was like to be growing up black, but as we look at it, man, doesn't that just, I mean, it really hurts seeing that as well. How do you react to it?
It does. And look, I've been pulled over like dozens of times for speeding or traffic violations or whatever over my life. And I've also been pulled over on the way to the airport with Del Curry and Muggsy Bogues, or with Chris Webber and Larry Johnson. And those traffic stops are completely different.
Yep.
They're completely different. And it's only because there are black people in the car.
Yep.
And my teammates, my sister has a biracial child. I've never talked to my kids about how they're supposed to behave when they're pulled over by a cop, because they're not going to get bothered by the cops. But all of my black friends, they have to have the talks with the kids about what you have to do. You've got to be yes or no, sir. And, you know, cross every T, dot every I, and it's heartbreaking, and we continue to see it. And I just, you know, watching this trial and then the Chauvin trial, while there's another shooting that happens in the city at the same goddamn time. And then another, you know, mass shooting yesterday in Indianapolis, or Indiana. It's something's got to give, right?
I hope it changes, but you know, it's not a new phenomenon. I mentioned Richard Pryor earlier, and there was a bit he used to do. He said, white people react differently to police than black people, because white people, you see them in your neighborhood and you go, hey, Officer Timkins, let's go bowling. And he said, I know them as, I am reaching for my wallet. Do not shoot my ass. And that was 40 years ago that he was talking about that. So
I'm not sure it's a lot different.
I think it's worse. I remember a time there was when it most became pronounced to me, when I first noticed it, because I saw it from, I was 16 and a buddy of mine, we were working at Burger King and we decided out in J-Town. And afterwards we decided, we knew a liquor store where somebody would buy beer for us.
Right.
And so we went and got a, you know, a six pack, because after all, we were stout young men and could handle three beers apiece. And on the way back, we're driving down 6 Mile Lane in Louisville, and a car passes us rather closely. And I said, wow, that car passed us kind of close. And then it turns out there was a bunch of, all I could say is they look like, you know, refugees from a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert without, you know, and they started chasing us through J-Town. And I thought, well, hell, this will be easy. You know, the cops will come along, because if you do 26 and a 25 in J-Town, the cops are there.
Right.
No cops, but I knew where Larry directed me. He knew where the J-Town police station was. So we drove to that, and he goes, here, make a left. And I hit the brakes, and he goes, no, the next one. So I stepped on the gas. The guys behind us were a little too close. So they ran into a telephone pole.
Oh, and so
we roll up on the J-Town police and we get out and we're scared.
Yeah.
And the cops came over and I said, look, there was a guy, they tried to run us off the road. I don't know what's going on. And they go, well, we've got them up there. And they say, you and your N-word tried to run him off the road. And I said, no, man, that's, and they treated us as if we were the criminals.
Oh my
simply
God.
Because Larry was black. We hadn't even opened a beer yet. So
and then you got beer on you.
Yeah. Luckily, you know? It was in the trunk and they never saw it. But when we drove back there to the scene, they made us go back to the scene. By then, one of the drunks that was, I mean, they got out of the car and it was like a sea of beer cans. When they got out, they took a swing at the cop. And thankfully, that ended all the, but it was, to me, it was like, I'm scared. You can see it in my face. We're getting out afraid. We came to you.
Terrified.
And we're terrified. And you want to blame us, because there was a car full of white kids. And then there was a car, you know, with a white and a black kid. So it had to be us that was at fault.
Yep.
That always, I don't know. I think Kentucky, honestly, it's a microcosm of the whole problem in the U.S. because there are places that are very open, but it's a red state and it didn't used to be that way.
And I never really knew that the Louisville Police Department was like it is. I really didn't. And, you know,
I didn't either.
One of my good buddies his name's Stephen Romines. He's one of the big criminal defense attorneys here in the state. He represents Breonna Taylor's boyfriend. He was going over some of the police stuff from the last few years, and it's really ugly. You know, we were just out having a beer one night, and my goodness,
something's got to change.
Just that, you know, as I think his interpretation on it is that, you know, there's been some racism and some
endemic.
And it's been exposed, but apparently not enough.
Well, no, you're going to have to get, a review board, a citizens review board, something has to be instituted. You know, they're saying in the Chauvin trial that American policing is on trial with this. And I'm going, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Because I worry about friends and relatives. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I have relatives that are Black.
Yes, you know, same.
And I have cousins, and you know, and you know, I honestly worry about.
It kills me. I mean, it doesn't kill me. It just crushes my spirit. You know, it's exhausting for me and for you. Imagine how exhausting it is to be Black.
Yeah. Well, the most exhausting thing for me in the last 4 years is just being in the White House dealing with Trump. There were days I came home and go, wow, if I were a drinking man, I wouldn't get up for weeks.
Right. My goodness.
Well, listen, it's always good to talk basketball and Sacha Baron Cohen with a fellow Kentucky boy.
That's right. Mix in a little Muhammad Ali.
Yep. And man, you're welcome to come back anytime. It's a lot of fun.
I'd love to come back. Sometime, all right, Brian. This has been really fun. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you. Rex, it was a pleasure. This is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. Please join us again next time.
At KPMG, our people make the difference. It's not just something we say, it's what we do. Combining the power of people and technology, we uncover brighter insights, innovate bolder solutions, and create better data-driven outcomes. KPMG, make the difference.